Hi there, this is Pete Way, and you're listening to Mark After Dark Show, and I hope you're enjoying it, just like me, rock and roll to the max.
Last year you were diagnosed with prostate cancer. How is your overall health been?
My overall health now is much, much better. They cleared the cancer. It takes actually about a year for the whole body or the area to repair itself.
Mm-hmm.
But up to this point, there's a few things that get affected, which is, without going too private, that down below, I'm not exactly Casanova at the moment. Apparently, I will be in about half a year's time, so.
Yeah, well, it takes time to heal. I had a friend that had cancer, and it was horrible, and he died of cancer, like, in 2008.
Oh,
so when
well,
I heard,
lucky, you see.
Yeah, when I heard you had cancer, you know, and
I'm glad we're talking about it, actually.
Yeah.
VIP ambassador actually, that's why I promised them that every time I did an interview, I would talk about it.
Sure.
So, it was one of those things. I had prostate cancer.
Yeah.
Which is the one that was easy, but if they catch it early enough, it's fine. But, and considering my lifestyle, and that suddenly, I mean, some people wouldn't even bother. I had to go in for what would be a minor test, and suddenly, there I am. I go, I'm afraid you've got prostate cancer. So they went, it's all right, though.
Mm-hmm.
Easy one, we can get rid of that. You know, don't worry. But it's the aftermath of it all, you know. But, I mean, I feel fine, you know. I don't think I'll be doing the Olympics, but
and you're playing music stuff, again,
you know?
Which is great.
Yeah, say that whatever happens, you know, it's my job to tell people, and I was the one with the lucky one. But if you're, I don't know, you could be sort of 20, and you could still need to be checked. It's always good, like they say, women with breast cancer and all that. I know it's not exactly a rock and roll thing, but
no, it doesn't have to be.
It saves lives, and so much the better. With the prostate cancer, then I was lucky, and a lot of people actually on my website have said thanks. I got checked, and I found out I did have prostate cancer. So I can only say that's brilliant, because trust me, I've pushed myself to the limit in my lifestyle, and that was just purely by chance, you know.
Well, I mean, at least you're getting better right now, and I'm glad to hear you're getting better. And I'm
getting ready. The album's going to be out.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it.
Fairly soon.
I'm really excited about hearing it.
It's really good. I mean, everybody's going to say their album's really good, but it becomes a particular significance. It's got a really raw edge to it. I've got Mike Clink doing it.
And yeah.
He's turned guns into sort of, I don't know, Gatling guns. You know, that sort of thing. Actually, me and Slash taught him everything he knows. Without me and Slash, he wouldn't be anybody today.
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, so how did he end up being
joking,
picked for this?
He's a genius, you know. He just told me, because I did certain things that were kind of, I thought were real good, and they're kind of a bit demo-ish and that, and I thought, oh, I like the sound of that, a demo-ish sound, or the garage rock and all that. And it's like, Mike goes, Pete, no, this is going to be really heavy. This is going to make people shit themselves. In actual fact, Pete, this album is going to be rock and roll laxative. I go, well, fair enough, Mike. He's now going, can we finish it now then? Can I actually go on tour?
Well, I'd love to see you if you make it to New York. I mean...
Oh, we're going to do a lot. We're going to do a world tour.
I mean, are you because I know you've had problems getting into the U.S., will you be able to get into the U.S.?
I think so, yeah.
So everything's
actually
worked out?
Interestingly enough, let me tell you this. I was talking to my friend Jimbo, who worked for Axel for a long time. He was working with Billy Idol, and I was telling Mike about me coming over to L.A., and I said, well, nobody wants to spend a fortune on lawyers and things like that, just get into the States. But Jimbo, he managed to be turned away from Australia. And I told, Mike knows him very well, because obviously working with Axel. And he went, well, whoever this lawyer is, he can't be much good, can he, if Jimbo got sent back from Australia. I spoke to my very good friend Adam, who Jimbo stays with at his place in Sherman Oaks, and Adam went, well, yeah, man. Yeah, but Jimbo didn't realise that if he didn't go through with a visa, they wouldn't get in. Well, I'll see what you mean, but
I hope so.
I'm going to make sure it was all 10 out of 10. You know, I can't wait to get to the States, because it's going to be really good, because the album is, as Mike says, this album's really heavy.
So who's in your band? Who's going to be playing alongside you?
I'm not sure at the moment, to be honest.
Mm.
I've been working with a member of Wasted, just because I wrote the songs and I got him to help me finish them off.
Which member?
Justin Paul.
Okay.
He's not like one of... Because Wasted always had different members.
Of course.
And it was really like a songwriting partner. Also, he was good at recording. Although Mike stripped everything. You know, we're talking about really heavy sound. I mean, everybody's heard it, said, wow, it's great.
I'm looking forward to hearing it. Totally.
Oh, I'll tell you what, it won't perish rock and roll laxative.
Okay, well, talking about Wasted, it was also reported that you had a falling out with your former Wasted bandmate, Finn Moore, and Ronnie Caulfield, over them attempting to release and tour without you. Is there more to this story, and is this the end of Wasted?
Story I could actually really say is that I was a bit surprised when, I'm doing a solo album, and they wanted to put out a bootleg from... Boston Gardens, I think it was. Might even been Madison Square Gardens. And what it is, I'm signed to Warner Brothers, and they own the name Wasted. So I couldn't give my name to let them put it out as a bootleg, even though I would have enjoyed taking the money, but I didn't want to be sued by the record company. And with Finn was going, it was in a dark sort of time of his life and that, and he, you know, it's like desperate to, let's get it out and that, and we'll get some money out of it. Well, for me, I didn't mind, but I didn't want to be sued by the record company. You know, they own the name Wasted. So it wasn't a falling out, far from it. I mean, I wanted it to go. It was just, there was Ronnie Caulfield playing guitar and Frank Noon playing drums. And it's me playing bass and...
Yeah, it's Wasted.
Yeah, Wasted.
I see it.
So, yeah, you know, sort of thing. So it wasn't Wasted, though. It's the thing. They want to put it out. Okay, fine. Do it. You can have my blessing. But I get told by Warner Brothers, no, we own the name because we bought the name from EMI. And to be truthful, we were in debt to EMI, took quite a lot of money because EMI threw a lot of money into the into the tour and stuff like that. So we never recouped. Mm-hmm. In actual fact, I ended up with my UFO royalties and the songwriting thing, having to help repay until Sony and Warners came in, but Sony and Warners still own the name. I don't own it.
Wow.
So if they want to put out a bootleg, which I said, yeah, fine, but they couldn't get it. They couldn't understand why I was saying no, but I just didn't want to be sued.
Mm-hmm.
Quite honestly, you know.
Yeah, yeah, no, I get it.
They cross-collateralise money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay for somebody saying, haven't been paid. Well, actually, yeah, you did get paid. You got paid about $400 a week for 2 years, and we also had to pay for the album. That has to be recouped. Record companies are like banks.
Yeah, they are. They come back hard, of course.
Well, that's why with this album of mine, I decided that I was going to pay for the lot myself, so I didn't get in that situation. I would never object to anybody not receiving money from the Wasted situation because I want them to, you
mm-hmm.
know. But quite honestly, Ronnie Caulfield got fired by the management, brought in another guitarist, and we, because of my friendship with Ozzy Osbourne, we managed to get the Ozzy Osbourne tour, but it wasn't, you know, the album didn't break down any doors.
Mm-hmm.
So, did my best, you know.
Of course.
But Finn was going through a sort of, I don't like to talk about people's drug use or drink use.
Well, it's rock and roll, but you don't have to.
Well, you know, it's like, I can't be accused of being not wanting it to go out. Actually, it was just that Finn was so drunk all the time that I don't care. I like working with drunks. They're great. But the thing is, to turn it around on me, no, it wasn't that at all.
Mm-hmm.
We asked Warner's lawyers, because quite frankly, I'd like it out, and I would have got some money out of it. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But no, I'm not getting any money out of it, because
mm-hmm.
it can't be put out, because we don't have the legal rights.
Yeah.
They own the name Wasted.
And that kind of stinks, because it's your band. I mean, you're Waste, you're Pete Way.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're going to get another bass player in. I think we're going to do American Wasted now.
Ridiculous.
Or, you know, which is, you know, but I mean, I was only being logical because I don't want to be sued, you know.
Well, I think it's ridiculous because it's your band. I mean, your Pete Way,
yeah.
It's called Wasted because it's your band. I mean,
well,
that's just my opinion.
Pete had a female friend, going around to everybody on my website that said exactly what you said, and he didn't want to. This guy said that, no, we can't, you know.
Well.
Or rather, should I say, you know,
I mean,
Pete's just being difficult.
Well, Pete, I mean, you left
difficult.
UFO and, you know, well, we'll get into the history for sure. And you formed
yeah.
Wasted after you left UFO. And you got these members to play.
Yeah.
It's in my mind, it doesn't matter what a record company says, even though, yeah, okay, they're like thieves, essentially.
To be honest with you, I've always been treated very well by the record company
mm-hmm.
I work for, And I say work for, to be honest with you, that's the wrong word, but they've always looked after me. They've paid way over the odds, you know, expecting more. And sometimes it turns out that, well, it hasn't happened.
Yeah.
And, but, I mean, a silly thing like Murray Cayfield's got this live disc, and I forget, I think it's Boston Gardens, it might be Madison Square Gardens, with Sporting Aussie, but, you know, I mean, that tour was supported and paid for by, actually, Chrysalis Records at
yeah.
the time. You know,
I mean, I saw you on that Aussie tour. I remember that. I mean,
did.
It was a long time ago.
Oh, yeah, I know. Trust me, I don't look that old. I'm not like a skeleton walking about or anything like that. But I'm like, well, what do I do? I'm not, you know, you want my signature. The funny thing was that they decided to try and do it without me because I was doing a solo album with Mike Clink.
Yeah.
And, you know, Finn didn't want to do Wasted because he said, oh, there's not enough money in it. Suddenly, somebody pops up with some money and he's there for it. Well, nothing to do with me. All I said was, legally, I can't do a thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd love to, you know.
Yeah.
I'd be very proud of it. I heard some of it. It sounds pretty good and all that. But it's like other people, and they initially started to do it behind the back. But I was the only person that didn't actually hear the actual songs or the performance.
Yeah, you didn't hear the recording.
No, all it was that Ronnie Cayfield asked for tape from the desk, which a lot of people do. I do sometimes. Can I listen to the desk tape, you know? And so that's how it was, really. I mean, it's, you know, it's disappointing, you know, to be honest with you, because I don't like to fall out with anybody.
Of course, you don't strike me as the type.
No, you know, it's like, it makes me look bad, and
well, that's what we're trying to clarify. I mean, that's why I'm asking. I saw the story.
Well, you're going around to people who are on my website, don't you know, Pete won't let this go out, and this and that.
Well,
actually, well, you get sued by Warner Brothers and see how you feel about it.
Well, let's go back in time and talk about you as a bass player. I mean, what made you decide that the bass would be your instrument? What influenced you?
Because when I was 16, I wasn't as good as my friend who played six-string guitar. So I thought, right, I'll stick to four. And then I thought, right, well, I'll get myself a good one. And so I started off with Fender Precision and moved my way up to a Gibson Thunderbird, that sort of thing. But literally, I can play six string. I write most of my songs on six string, but you know, you go to four string, then I'm a Thunderbird man. I'm a, you know, I like playing bass too.
What influenced you as a bass player?
Influenced me. I don't know, just wanted to be like the people that I admired.
Well, who did you admire?
Well, Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin, I think the usual people. I think Bill Wyman actually was very underestimated, but as far as I know, Keith Richards played an awful lot of bass rather than Bill, because it's like, when I write songs, I might write the six string, and I might write the bass guitar parts as well, you know.
Yeah.
Well, not write them, you know.
You play them.
Record it, and yeah, exactly. There's so many different people that I respect that I feel bad about not even mentioning their names, because there's so many damn good bass players about that have influenced people.
Well, you've influenced a lot of people, too. You're based
well,
on...
Well, I have, yeah. I mean, I'm grateful for you saying that, Mark, but, you know, there's people that I might have heard one song, and I go, that's great bass playing. It's like with Duff, with Guns and that. Maybe Duff heard me and liked what he did. Mm-hmm. I mean, perhaps that's the case. You know, I like bass players that weren't bass players, if you see what I mean.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I was probably a frustrated six-string player. Mm. And when you get a frustrated six-string player, then if you're doing bass playing, you go, oh, I'm, you know. I mean, okay, I'm a bit lost there, but I would say that when you get the opportunity to play with Michael Schenker, for instance, people of that quality, then it makes your bass playing better. And I learned the roots of bass playing, that sticking really tight with the drums and mm-hmm. things like that. And what Michael would always say to me, don't overplay, just play behind me. So that he could do his melodies without me going diddle-la-la-la-la-la-la, sort of thing when he's trying to go diddle-la-la-la-la-la-la. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'd be going dun 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 dun.
So tell me about your first meeting with the original guitarist of UFO, Mick Bolton.
Very interesting. I think I met him through Phil Mogg.
Really?
Actually, yeah. I mean, we were just would-be hippies, but we weren't hippies. We were just like, we just got together and listened to music all night because we were taking speed. Or something stab all night and listen to Doors or something like that.
Well, it says in the High Stakes and Dangerous Men book written by Neil Daniels that Mick Bolton introduced you to Phil Mogg. I guess it's reversed.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, it's exactly the same.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Mick did, because it was like, you know, they were friends and what happened was, what do you do? Like, whatever age we were, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Was it 16, 15? We stayed mm-hmm. up all night. Like the song, Last Train's 11, it's now quarter past, sort of thing. We stayed up all night and that, and we couldn't go home. So we just took speed and stayed up and listened to the Doors and things like that.
Okay.
And got into music.
Well, the band you formed with Mick Bolton and the original drummer, Tick Torazzo, was called The Boyfriends before changing its name to Hocus Pocus. And then The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. What was the material like, and how did it differ from the music heard on UFO 1 and the second UFO Flying album?
I could go and get my acoustic guitar and sing to you, and you could throw up as I play. I just pop music, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, we thought, right, we're going to be like Sabbath, we're going to be like this and that. Actually, probably bands like The Move and The Who and that, where they would do sort of acoustic-y things that did it, because we obviously like being in the bedroom, that you play fairly quietly, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you get a drummer, and then we had Tick, who's I was 16 and a half or something like that, and so obviously you've got to find somewhere where your mum and dad don't mind, in the garage, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And then you had a drummer named Colin Turner before meeting Andy Parker.
Yeah, he smelled fish. Phil didn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, for whatever, because apparently he went, of course, stinks of fish. So,
oh, my God.
Oh, I'm not joking. I mean it. He went, thank God for that. And then Andy came along, and Andy was great because he could fix the cables. Because
mm-hmm.
we met him in a pub with our local friends, not quite sure what age we mm-hmm. were, probably 17 or something. And anyway, it's like, he's a drummer. Okay, because we're thinking of getting rid of this drummer because he smells of fish. And anyway, as it would happen, Andy came down. We did a rehearsal, and Andy fixed all the cables and everything because, you know, like, I'm sure every band that's just starting up will know this. Like, you get and they go, oh, I think it's working. No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. So, I'll do it. No, come on, leave it with me, because that's no good. So he fixed all the cables. We thought, right, well, we're not losing this bloke.
Was there... did you feel an instant chemistry, or did that happen over time?
You know, the thing is, the original meeting with Andy was in a pub,
mm-hmm.
a great English tradition, so consequently, yeah, there was chemistry. Actually, to be honest with you, we were very tight-knit, and we didn't like people we didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
So if we didn't like them, that's it. You know, I don't care if there was Eric Clapton... You know, but, no, I suppose we'd have taken Eric on, but, you know, it was a nice setup because we built up a band,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think Michael often says in chemistry's, in his interviews that it's chemistry that actually creates something, and in a way it was, because
mm-hmm.
let's be honest, I mean, I don't know if you play yourself or you're...
I have.
Interesting. Well, you know, I mean, if you put together a band, you have a chemistry, and if the chemistry isn't there, well, okay, you're just trying, but you're never going to go any further than sort of mm-hmm. trying with each other, or can't stand him and that. And how on earth are you going to write songs?
Mm-hmm.
You know, once in a while, yeah, it works. But, you know, it's like as soon as anybody gets the opportunity, the band that you've created that suddenly got a hit single is broken up because nobody likes one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, know? It happens a million times over.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You know.
Well, UFO made their first ever live appearance as UFO at Fagan's Blues Workshop in late 1969. Tell me about the reaction of the audience.
Is that in the States, you mean, or is that in...
You know, in England.
Oh. I really don't know, to be honest with you, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, come on, look, it's not exactly making history, is it?
Well, it did, because it was... To me, personally, and I'll tell you the truth, I actually liked those first three records, even though a lot of people would say, oh,
yeah.
no, those... I think they were really good blues-based hard rock albums with
yeah.
a little bit of a spacey thing
well,
going.
I've got to tell you, it's I was talking to a friend of mine who's a total rock connoisseur, and actually, he runs a vintage record store,
mm-hmm.
and... he said to me, I actually went round to King Diamond's house, or Kim Peterson, actually, that's his real name.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking for his collection, apart from the Skinnings, and I saw our very first album. And I told this guy, I said, I went round to Kim's place, and what my friend said was, I said, can't believe it. You had our first album, UFO 1. He went, of course. Or every true metal fan has that album.
It's a great, believe it or not, it's actually, I know a lot of people diss it and they don't consider it to be the first album, but it is. I mean, even though Phenomenon, which came later, is a better record, no doubt in my mind. I'm a big fan of Phenomenon and that period of time.
Yeah. But well, it's a whole different world, though, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You listen to that. But funny enough, you listen back and you go, I can hear my youth shouting out at me, you know. Like, God, I might be able to work on playing three strings tomorrow. That sort of thing, rather than, you know, oh, and then I'll get to four. That sort of thing, you know.
Well, like we were talking about, UFO went into Jackson's studio with Doug Felt on a shoestring budget of 500 pounds and recorded UFO One. You wrote the song Follow You, which is one of your first compositions. Can you tell me how it differs from how you write how you wrote music back in the 70s and now?
I still wrote on six-string, but I write kind of to the best of my ability on the six-string. But, you know, Mick Bolton was a better six-string player than me and gave me the opportunity to, nobody questioned, like, if it was two or three chords, because we grew up with two or three chords, you know, these sort of bands, obviously we weren't working on the harmonies. That's where Phil Mogg came in, because Phil could sing, and me and Mick were trying to be like these bands that did the harmonies and this and that, and I can't think of a particular band that I would say we were trying to be like.
Well, Follow You.
I know we wanted it really loud. And
well, Follow You reminds me, sort of your writing style on that reminds me a lot of the Kinks. Were you a fan of the Kinks at that
Kinks
time?
Yeah, Kinks were definitely in there.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely in there, Mark. You know, Kinks, The Who, Rolling Stones, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much the Beatles, actually. I was never really a Beatles fan. But same time, I mean, I think it was because I just regarded them as a pop band as opposed to a real band. To me, real bands were like decadent, like the Pretty Things and, you know, people like that. Early Bowie, things like that, you know. So that's the best way I could describe it, you know.
Okay, well, the band...
Odd was it kind of grew. We didn't like go, right, let's change everybody in the band. It just like he went, somebody else joined, and things, and then gradually you get to the Phenomenon album, which changed
dramatically.
But the, you know, the master race coming in, and you know,
I don't know
that
if I
was all by accident.
Well, going back to the beginning, the band started doing shows with the progressive rock band Caravan at the time. What was what was it like working with a band?
You've certainly done your research, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. I mean, what was it like working with a band of that caliber?
It didn't really matter because we just played the way we wanted to play. In those days, it was like everybody played how can I put it? Everybody played the way they wanted to play. They didn't care whether somebody was progressive rock or somebody was hard rock. It was all in its own dimension at that point.
That's what music should be, honestly.
Well, you know, what actually happened with us, and I'll skip a beat here, with us, when we started to get popular, we ended up working with, I mean, dare I say it, bands like AC/DC.
Of course.
Whose Priest is our special guest.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they'd all been through the mill, you know. They'd played with bands that, you know, like, i.e. your Caravans and stuff like
that. Oh, yeah.
We just regarded it as, oh, I like this type of music, and that's the type of music I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and very much
played with Thin Lizzy too.
Well, you know, it's like In a way, it was almost like a war. Like, well, our music style is better than your music style.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of thing, you know.
The complete rivalry, almost.
Well, you know, we didn't have a problem, but there would be people that came just along for to enjoy themselves.
Of course.
Actually, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you put Caravan on with us and AC/DC, I don't think they'd be lasting too long on the stage. Yeah.
I don't think so. I think it's...
You know, so, I mean, early days, actually, I think we're very, very... Well, of course they've got to be important in your build-up to your career, because you start to take notice of things that... Do you like things that you're interested in? But in a way, it's like, oh, I don't like bands like that. And there's nothing wrong with them. I mean, they're good musicians. For me, I'd go and put on Black Sabbath album, and that would be it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Pete and Black Sabbath, you know, and or Zeppelin, you know. Yeah.
UFO released a live album in 1972, simply entitled UFO Live. The album was recorded in Japan. UFO were one of the first British bands, along with Deep Purple, to tour and record in Japan. The Eddie Cochran cover, Come On Everybody, off of UFO One, was a big hit there. Were you surprised by the Japanese audience when you got there?
To be honest with you, I was totally surprised about everything around that time, because it's like, it's all so unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go from playing like the Marquee Club, which is where everybody used to play, even The Who and Jimi Hendrix and people like that. It's a small club where everybody makes their start in the world of rock in England, and later on, you know, if you can conquer the Marquee Club audience, then it spreads, the word spreads to around the country, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, it was very strange, because, yeah, I mean, you know, we were over there, and we had a hit with Boogie for George, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And this is me going back to, people wouldn't even think I would remember this, but had a hit with that, and so therefore we went over, and they said, oh, we'll record it, and so lo and behold, we recorded it, but, you know, it's an awful lot of people there, and we adapted. I don't know what it was, but we were, I guess, natural show-offs.
Mm-hmm. Well, after the departure of Mick Bolton, Larry Wallace stepped in and took his place briefly. Later,
yeah.
Wallace joined Motorhead, predating Fast Eddie Clark. Wallace's replacement was Bernie Marsden, one of the nicest guys I ever interviewed.
Oh, Bernie, yeah, he was lovely. I mean, ironically enough, with us, you know, we wanted to look like... We didn't want to look like glam rock, but we wanted to look like pretty cool, if that's
mm-hmm.
the right word. And Bernie was more like very, I don't know, he had his own image, which wasn't, it wasn't exactly David Bowie, but what a nice guy.
Yeah, he later joined Coverdale and Whitesnake. What was your impression of these two guitar players when they were in UFO?
Well, Larry was a hippie, and he thought he was in the MC5, which is great for me. I liked all that.
Mm-hmm.
We were in another world, actually, of songwriting, and it wasn't really songwriting in those days. It was
mm-hmm.
More seeing what we came up with at rehearsals, you know. And Larry was a bit... I don't know, I wouldn't say noisy for us, but he wasn't so, we were very much into the song, whereas, I don't know, in some ways, Larry was more into the sort of noise of it all, you know, except for that we did play loud, and it was a nice step, but when Bernie came in, he brought in that sort of blues element, sort of, it made us very structured in a way, you know. We could do long solos, short solos and that, but it was very solid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it helped me and Andy, actually, because whereas Larry possibly be all over the place doing his sort of psychedelic rock, with Bernie, he had the same mindset as we did, and it was a good little combo, actually, I think you could say.
Mm-hmm.
It was only the four of us, you know.
Well, if either Larry Wallace or Bernie Marsden would have stayed, what direction do you think UFO would have taken?
Probably in a similar direction. It was just that, with myself and Phil, for instance, we were so into sort of learning about really good guitar players, and we like flash guitar players, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, ironically enough, when Michael joined, he joined because Bernie wasn't over. He'd something to do with a passport, whatever reason. Michael just
moved
in. It was just so natural.
Yeah.
We were lucky. You know, it was meant to be.
Of course. It's classic. Okay, in 1973, UFO recorded a couple of demos with Bernie on guitar. 16,
yeah.
The original Oh My, Give Her the Gun, and Sweet Little Thing with Dave Edmonds as producer. These songs appeared on the 2008 remaster and reissue version of Phenomenon as bonus tracks.
I've actually heard that, to be honest, and you probably go, why not? It's so many different remasters.
Yeah, well, this was, and actually, I loved the way he sounded. How did UFO meet and record with Dave Edmonds, and what was it like working with Bernie Marsden on these songs?
The in-house producer engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Chrysalis Records hired him because they were trying to cement our record deal, but they were looking for a sort of singly type song that would be like the main song for an album.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing. So, having said that, we hadn't written a great deal. It wasn't until Michael came along that we started writing, be it together, although, I mean, a lot of those songs were, this Phil and Michael credited, but it was very much a band effort. With Bernie, it was kind of, Bernie's Bernie, you know, he's a good solid lead guitar player, and whereas with Michael, for instance, and our attitude, we kind of let ourselves go a bit because we knew that we could live on the edge when we were playing live and we could record, you know.
Mm-hmm. At the time of Bernie Marsden's decision to leave UFO, you were encouraging him to remain in the band despite his own feelings of not fitting in. Were you surprised by his suggestion of getting Michael to replace him?
It wasn't Michael. We'd already asked Michael to join. Michael was actually in the band by then.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably for Bernie. I think it was one of those things that it was obvious.
Yeah.
We were very happy. Rudolf Schenker was very happy too, and so was Klaus Mein. I think they, as Michael said, no, actually, as we said, be like, great, those stupid Englanders, they have taken him. Little did we know what a ball of fire Michael could be.
Oh, yeah.